I mean, even Abraham wanted his Ishmael. Oh, that Ishmael may stay before my eyes forever. I'll cut it out. And then he had to even lay Isaac, as we will see. But just relax. Mine is a torn out heart. And the pain that Jesus must have felt to know he chose and worked and was being betrayed by the same one. He even trusted him to carry the bag. No excuse for me, but it's comfortable. It's comforting, rather. I never really thought I was perfect. Just perfect in certain ways. Not very many. Just few little. And God showed me I'm not, even in those areas. Men have now by nature no peace within their hearts, for God is crowned in their hearts no longer, but there in the moral dusk, that's what these crises do, they make you look a little more closely in the moral dusk. Stubborn and aggressive usurpers fight among themselves for first place on the throne. This is not a mere metaphor, but an accurate analysis of our real spiritual trouble. There is within the human heart a tough, fibrous root of fallen life whose nature is to possess, always to possess. It covets things with a deep and fierce passion. I don't know why this congregation trusts me absolutely with the money. You know you can. Because it doesn't mean anything to me. That's one problem I don't have. You know what the world's way is? Divide that control with the money so the preacher can't misuse it. Well, I agree that there are lots of preachers you can't trust that way, but they're pretty easy to recognize. What I've learned is you trust me with it. When I trust other people, they may not have the same attitude I have. Because I really, in that regard, am freed from things a long time ago. There is within the human heart a tough, fibrous root of fallen life whose nature is to possess, always to possess. I've been dispossessing, doing it in front of you for years. And then I end up, I really have secrets, don't I? I don't know how many houses that I call address. So my biggest conflicts is, where do I sleep tonight? Big secret that we have horses and ranch and new tennis courts and private golf course and jets and limousines. Isn't that a wonderful secret? We don't ever ask you to give money because somebody suffered. You give money because of the teaching. But way down deep, you all know, about once a week, I wish God would call me to Calcutta with a one-way ticket and my little black bag. God can trust me with that. Doesn't mean anything to me. It's been a long time since I've sold any of my paintings. I'm still painting. Doesn't matter to me. Things don't bother me. So all the devil has to do is get me to trust somebody absolutely to whom things matter. Adam wasn't looking at the tree, Eve was. But Adam was looking at Eve. You follow the sequence? And God gave her to him. Back to Tozer. I'm coming out of this valley. There's nothing phony about me when I start. It's hard to stay with just Tozer now. A week and a half ago, I wouldn't have looked up from the book. The roots of our heart have grown down into things, and we dare not pull up one rootlet lest we die. Things have become necessary to us. A development never originally intended. God's gifts now take the place of God. And the whole course of nature is upset by the monstrous substitution. The tree was more important than God's voice at the end of the day. You know, when you fall in love with a tree, you don't want to hear God's voice at the end of the day. You cover yourself and hide. Wouldn't it have been wonderful if Eve was hiding and Adam was saying with God, why'd you do it and why are you hiding? I intend to say to Adam, when I get up there, you dumb jerk, I proved you could do what you didn't do about the things. Our Lord referred to this tyranny of things when he said to his disciples, same as every one of these preachers, they go back to this verse. If any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whosoever will save his life shall lose it, and whosoever shall lose his life for my sake shall find it. Breaking this truth into fragments for our better understanding, it would seem that there is within each of us an enemy which we tolerate at our peril. Jesus called it life and self. Or as we would say, the self-life. Its chief characteristic is its possessiveness. The words gain and profit suggest this. To allow this enemy to live is in the end to lose everything. To repudiate it and give it up, all of it for Christ's sake, is to lose nothing at last, but to preserve everything unto life eternal. And there's a hint given here as to the only effective way to destroy this foe. It is by the cross. Let him take up his cross and follow me. I accept it now. Didn't know it was going to be hard to die to something that ministered to the self-life. The way to deeper knowledge of God is through the lonely valleys of soul poverty and abnegation of all things. The blessed ones who possess the kingdom are they who have repudiated every external thing and have rooted from their hearts all sense of possessing. These are poor in spirit. It doesn't mean beat down and morbid. It means poor in the sense of having nothing, in the spirit, needing nothing. So you're poor in spirit. They've reached an inward state paralleling the outward circumstances of the common beggar in the streets of Jerusalem. That's what the word poor, as Christ used it, actually means. These blessed poor are no longer slaves to the tyranny of things. They've broken the yoke of the oppressor, and this they've done not by fighting, but by surrendering. Though free from all sense of possessing, they yet possess all things. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Let me exhort you to take this seriously. It's not to be understood as mere Bible teaching, to be stored away in the mind along with an inert mass of other doctrines. I like the way he talks. It is a marker on the road to greener pastures, a path chiseled against the steep sides of the Mount of God. We dare not try to bypass it if we would follow on in this holy pursuit. We must ascend a step at a time, and if we refuse one step... F.B. Meyer is another one that I lived with through the years. He once said, sanctification or separation from self to God is like climbing a stairway, each step of which is our former dead self. We struggle with one step, and that which holds us and competes with God dies, and then when we're on that step, we're standing a little higher, and we see another step, another self that has to die, or another part of ourself. And when it dies, we stand on it, and that gives the perspective to see another one. That's why I've said to you, the more mature the saint, the greater the test. I'm surprised at myself for being surprised, but my teaching is not supposed to be for me, it's for you. But I say that with a smile. Yeah, it's for me. You know it's for me. You know I know it's for me. I'm further down the way of following him. I'm in the way with him. The cross came at the end of his ministry, the toughest test that he was prepared for. Why shouldn't I, now that I'm starting to see more clearly, have expected this year to bring the toughest test I've ever faced? Back to the guns. You on radio, I'm talking about my lighters. You pull the trigger and a flame comes out. But they look like guns. As is frequently true, this New Testament principle of spiritual life finds its best illustration in the Old Testament. Here we go. You're learning all the secrets of the way God led me to shape my ministry. That's why I don't pay too much attention to the shallow-minded traditional preachers of today. I compare their diatribes to this. Their simple little neat packages to this. Their 2 and 2 make 4 gospel to this. How many times have you heard me say the Old Testament unfolds in the New? The New Testament is enfolded in the Old. He's just saying it differently. As is frequently true, this New Testament principle of spiritual life finds its best illustration in the Old Testament. In the story of Abraham and Isaac, we have a dramatic picture of the surrendered life, as well as an excellent commentary on the first beatitude, blessed are the poor in spirit. Abraham was old when Isaac was born. Old enough to have been his grandfather. And the child became at once the delight and idol of his heart. For From that moment when he first stooped to take the tiny form awkwardly in his arms, he was an eager, love slave of his son. When you've waited as long as he waited, you understand his love. When you wait, you can go overboard. God went out of his way to comment on the strength of this affection. And it is not hard to understand. The baby represented everything sacred to his father's heart, the promises of God, the covenants, the hopes of years, the long messianic dream. And as he watched him grow from babyhood to young manhood, the heart of the old man was knit closer and closer with the life of his son, till at last the relationship bordered upon the perilous. Widen your perspective and let it be any relationship that in your mind fulfills dreams and hopes. It becomes perilous when it crowds in upon the focus of eternal hope, eternal love, eternal calling, the one that must always be first. It bordered on the perilous. It was then that God stepped in to save both father and son from the consequences of an uncleansed love. "Take now thy son," said God to Abraham, "thine only son Isaac, whom thou lovest, and get thee into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains which I will tell thee of." The sacred writer spares us a close-up of the agony that night on the slopes near Beersheba when the aged man had it out with his God. And he did. I can be sure of that, and so can you. You haven't been spared as you've watched me have it out with God. But respectful imagination may view in awe the bent form and convulsive wrestling alone under the stars. Possibly not again until a greater than Abraham wrestled in the Garden of Gethsemane did such a mortal pain visit a human soul. Funny, there are moments when we, all of us, think we're the only ones. If only the man himself might have been allowed to die, that would have been easier 1,000 times. For he was old now, and to die would have been no great ordeal for one who had walked so long with God. Besides, it would have been a last sweet pleasure to let his dimming vision rest upon the figure of his stalwart son, who would live to carry on the Abrahamic line and fulfill in himself the promises of God made long before Ur of the Chaldees. I'll tell you something. Tozer's right. I don't doubt for a minute that Abraham considered suicide that night. What was God going to do about it? God would still keep his word for Isaac. He had Isaac. For better that he die. God didn't know what he was doing. Frank told you dead right. I'm not going to take a station break. I'm going to go right through it. How should he slay the lad? Even if he could get the consent of his wounded and protesting heart. You can read the Bible through in 92, 82, 72, and think that, a la Bill Cosby, God said, "Take now thy son and go offer him on Mount Moriah." Right. "Now lay me down to sleep, pray the Lord my soul to keep, and sleep, and get up the next morning, go do it. Put yourself in his place. The agony of the night. There had to be some movement from the claim that God made to the obedience the next morning. That had to be the longest night of Abraham's life. There is no way under heaven he could have dreamed, expected, imagined, or thought the thought that God would say this, drop this bomb on him, expect him to do this. Have you ever had anything hit you in the gut? In the middle of the night, when Satan's forces are there to abuse, and cried through that night, well, at least in this case, Abraham didn't have any doubt as to what God was saying. I hope it's not rationalization. But I think if I had God come and say, this is what has to happen, I could have gotten through it in one night too. I'm more like Job. I get hit out of the blue because God removed the hedge and Satan did his work. Took Job a little longer. Anybody tells you Job didn't sin, he's crazier than a lunatic, knows nothing about the Bible. He complained plenty, but he eventually came to the point. And not in the first night concerning God, not even understanding what was hitting him. Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. I'm getting there. But I feel for Abraham with his one night. Job, I'm more in tune with, because he couldn't see God's hand in what was happening. All he sees is the devil that God let do his work. But they both came to the same conclusion. One took a little longer. How should he slay the lad? Even if he could get the consent of his wounded and protesting heart, how could he reconcile the act with the promise? I know that wrestling. This was the year of miracles. No time for a setback. How could he reconcile the act with the promise, in Isaac shall thy seed be called? Now God says, kill him. This was Abraham's trial by fire, and he did not fail in the crucible. He could have. I still could. But there's less chance tonight than there was a few weeks ago. Blessed be God. And the life-giving strength of his word. While the stars still shone like sharp white points above the tent where the sleeping Isaac lay, and long before the gray dawn had begun to lighten the east, the old saint had made up his mind. He would offer his son as God had directed him to do, and then trust God to raise him from the dead. I've told you, that's why James is wrong. Abraham was not just obedient. His was the obedience fueled by faith. Because, though Tozer won't point it out, you read the chapter. When he left the men at the bottom of the hill and went up the hill, he said to them, "We shall return. Not I shall return." He expected a resurrection. This, says the writer of the Hebrews, was the solution his aching heart found sometime in the dark night. And he rose early in the morning to carry out the plan. It is beautiful to see that while he erred as to God's method, he had correctly sensed the secret of his great heart. He knew God would have an answer. He just take comfort in that fact, because I sure do. All men of God try to second guess God. Because he had the faith to believe God would raise Isaac from the dead, he didn't even have to kill him. But I'm ahead of the story. It's beautiful to see that while he erred as to God's method, he had correctly sensed the secret of God's great heart, and the solution accords well with the New Testament scripture, "Whosoever will lose his life for my sake shall find it unto life eternal." God let that suffering old man go through with it up to the point where he knew there would be no retreat. That painting in the foyer of our church is an icon because it says everything we've been trying to teach for these 19 years. God let that suffering old man go through with it up to the point where he knew there would be no retreat. And then forbade him to lay a hand upon the boy. I have really taken the heart ripped out of me and laid it in front of God and said, "Stomp on it if you want to. No retreat." To the wondering patriarch, he now says, in effect, "It's all right, Abraham. I never intended that you should actually slay the lad. I only wanted to remove him from the temple of your heart that I might reign unchallenged there. I wanted to correct the perversion that existed in your love." I love to look at that painting by the old master, the genius who captured on that canvas in the foyer the look of surprise on Abraham's face. I hope when we go to music they find the pictures of that painting. The look of total surprise and shock on Abraham's face, in his eyes. And you know he never expected God to stay his hand. He had another solution. "Now you may have the boy sound and well. Take him and go back to your tent. I wanted to correct the perversion that existed in your love. There is nothing good and pure. And the greatest of all expressions of the Spirit, 1 Corinthians, is love. Satan will come and try to twist that and pervert it. I wanted to correct the perversion that existed in your love. Now you may have the boy sound and well. Take him and go back to your tent. Now I know that thou fearest God, seeing that thou hast not withheld thy son, thine only son, from me." Then heaven opened. I'm actually looking forward to this now. Then heaven opened. Because I believe it's going to happen. "Then heaven opened and a voice was heard saying to him, I once went through the whole Old Testament, taking the Hebrew word translated for the sake of. Seeing God act for the sake of His name, His word, for the sake of my servant David, for the sake of my servant Abraham. But here He suddenly responds to Abraham for the sake of Himself. By Myself have I sworn, saith the Lord, for behold, Thou hast done this thing, and hast not withheld Thy Son, Thine only Son, that in blessing I will bless thee, and in multiplying I will multiply thy seed as the stars of the heaven, and as the sand which is upon the seashore. And thy seed shall possess the gate of his enemies, and in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because thou hast obeyed my voice. The old man of God lifted his head to respond to the voice and stood there on the mount, strong and pure and grand, a man marked out by the Lord for special treatment. A friend and favorite of the Most High. Now he was a man wholly surrendered, a man utterly obedient, a man who possessed nothing. He had concentrated his all in the person of his dear Son, and God had taken it from him. God could have begun out on the margin of Abraham's life and worked inward to the center. He chose rather to cut quickly to the heart and have it over in one sharp act of separation. In dealing thus, he practiced an economy of means and time. I laugh because I know these things, and yet it hurt cruelly, but it was effective. I have said that Abraham possessed nothing. Yet was not this poor man rich? Everything he had owned before was still his to enjoy. Sheep, camel, herds, and goods of every sort. He had also his wife and his friends, and best of all, he had his son Isaac. Safe by his side, he had everything, but he possessed nothing. There is the spiritual secret. There is the sweet theology of the heart, which can be learned only in the school of renunciation. The books on systematic theology overlook this, but the wise will understand. After that bitter and blessed experience, I think the words "my" and "mine" never had again the same meaning for Abraham. The sense of possession which they connote was gone from his heart. Things had been cast out forever. They had now become external to the man. His inner heart was free from them. And the world said, Abraham is rich, but the aged patriarch only smiled. He couldn't explain it to them. But he knew that he owned nothing, that his real treasures were inward and eternal. There can be no doubt that this possessive clinging to things is one of the most harmful habits in the life. Because it is so natural, it is rarely recognized for the evil that it is. But its outworkings are tragic. We are often hindered from giving up our treasures to the Lord out of the fear for their safety. This is especially true when those treasures are loved relatives and friends, but we need have no such fears. Our Lord came not to destroy, but to save. Everything is safe when we commit it to Him. Nothing is really safe when it's not so committed. Our gifts and talents should also be turned over to Him. They should be recognized for what they are, God's loan to us, and should never be considered in any sense our own. We have no more right to claim credit for special ability than for blue eyes or strong muscles. Quote the scripture, "For who maketh thee to differ from another, and what hast thou that thou didst not receive?" The Christian who is alive enough to know himself even slightly will recognize the symptoms of this possession malady and will grieve to find them in his own heart. If the longing after God is strong enough within him, he'll want to do something about the matter. Now, what should he do? First of all, he should put away all defense and make no attempt to excuse himself, either in his own eyes or before the Lord. That's why I tell you, I went first to blaming myself. I know the laws of the Spirit and how they operate. Whoever defends himself will have himself for his defense, and he will have no other. But let him come defenseless before the Lord, and he will have for his defender no less than God himself. Let the inquiring Christian trample underfoot every slippery trick of his deceitful heart and insist upon frank and open relations with the Lord. Then he should remember that this is holy business. No careless or casual dealings will suffice. Let him come to God in full determination to be heard. Let him insist that God accept his all and that he take things out of his heart and himself reign, that is, God himself reign there in power. It may be he will need to become specific, to name things and people by their names one by one. And you'll find, usually, there's one or two you don't want on the list. Because God must know. That this needs to stay. If he will become drastic enough, he can shorten the time of his travail from years to minutes and enter the good land long before his slower brethren who coddle their feelings and insist upon caution in their dealings with God. Let us never forget that such a truth as this cannot be learned by rote as one would learn the facts of physical science. That's why I'm still having to learn it. They must be experienced before we can really know them. We must in our hearts live through Abraham's harsh and bitter experiences if we would know the blessedness which follows them. The ancient curse will not go out painlessly. The tough old miser within us will not lie down and die obedient to our command. He must be torn out of our heart like a plant from the soil. He must be extracted in agony and blood like a tooth from the jaw. He must be expelled from our soul by violence as Christ expelled the money changers from the temple. And we shall need to steel ourselves against the piteous begging that comes from our heart, saying no, and recognize it as springing out of self-pity, one of the most reprehensible sins of the human heart. See, as I told you earlier, these guys don't listen to me. They just talk right, and they talk right. What is there to listen to? They're giving the truth. I mean, why should they listen to me if I'm going to argue? If we would indeed know God in growing intimacy, and I do want that, we must go this way of renunciation. And if we are set upon the pursuit of God, he will sooner or later bring us to this test. And I would say again and again, Abraham's testing was at the time not known to him as such. Yet, if he had taken some other course than the one he did, the whole history of the Old Testament would have been different. God would have found his man, no doubt, but the loss to Abraham would have been tragic beyond the telling. So we will be brought one by one to the testing place, and we may never know when we are there. Thank God I know. At that testing place, there will be no dozen possible choices for us. Just one and an alternative. Either or. But our whole future will be conditioned by the choice we make. Take heart, congregation. I have made my decision. And I have made my choice. And as C.S. Lewis said, I repeat it again. There are only two kinds of people in the end. Those that say to God, "Thy will be done." And those to whom God says in the end, "Thy will be done." I've made my choice. I hope you make yours. And the right one, as I have. Now go and telephone.